You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, from Gaza and Lebanon to Kabul and Ukraine, we'll discuss the day's top stories with Shashank Joshi and Daniela Pellet here in the studio. Then we'll find out why there isn't a drop to drink in Sao Paulo.
There's been a record drought here, and I think that combined with some really serious problems of infrastructure and lack of investment are actually causing a record problem, and it's making people quite nervous here.
We'll take a look at the latest and open inverted commas greatest close inverted commas in Australian television.
We don't want to be like the Argentinians. A frog that beautiful makes you look insecure.
Also, we don't want to look like a country that objectifies frogs.
Yeah, Australia already has a pretty big inferiority complex.
The biggest inferiority complex in the Southern Hemisphere.
And we'll delve into the dangerous allure of the unseen, it says here, with the author Philip Ball. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, right now. A very great deal indeed coming up in the next 58 and a half minutes here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
NATO has warned Russia could be poised to invade Ukraine. It says 20,000 combat-ready troops amassed on the country's border and warns Russia could use the pretext of a humanitarian or peacekeeping mission to invade. NATO says the build-up of troops has further escalated an already dangerous situation. Earlier this week, Russia announced plans for a military exercise near the border with Ukraine involving fighter jets and bombers. A ceasefire in Gaza has now held for 36 hours. Thousands of people who had fled their homes during the conflict are now returning, and Israeli and Palestinian representatives are holding separate talks in Egypt in the hope of agreeing a longer-term deal. At the UN in New York, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has said what he called the senseless cycle in Gaza must be broken.
The nightmare of the last 4 weeks has been a terrible reminder that only a negotiated political settlement can bring security and peace to Israelis and Palestinians alike.
Officials in Saudi Arabia are investigating what could be the first Ebola death outside Africa in the current outbreak. A man was being treated in Jeddah for Ebola-like symptoms. The World Health Organization is holding an emergency meeting to discuss how to contain the outbreak. New figures show that more than 900 lives have been lost across West Africa. At a summit of African leaders in Washington, D.C., President Obama has promised America's support.
Our thoughts and prayers are those who have been affected by the Ebola outbreak. The United States and our international partners will continue to do whatever we can to help our African partners respond to this crisis and to stand with the people of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. In their histories, they've overcome great challenges, and they are drawing on that same spirit of strength and resilience today.
Iraqi officials claim that as many as 60 suspected militants died in a drone strike in the rebel-held city of Mosul. It targeted a prison being used as a base by ISIS fighters who gained control of the city 2 months ago. Meanwhile, UN groups have warned that at least 40,000 members of one of Iraq's oldest minorities, the Yazidi sect, have taken refuge on a remote mountain in the far northwest of Iraq, fearing ISIS militants will kill them if they flee. The Afghan soldier who opened fire at a military complex, killing a senior U.S. officer, had been in the army for 3 years. The U.S. military says Major General Harold Green was a true hero, the most senior figure to be killed in combat since the Vietnam War. He was killed as he visited a training facility in Kabul. Lieutenant Colonel Juanita Chang is a spokeswoman for the U.S. Army.
Our hearts and prayers go out to the family, and I have spoken to the family, and the family has asked that I pass along that they believe that the Army, as well as Afghanistan and America, has lost a true hero today. He really believed in what he was doing over there and was really proud to serve, and the family would like that to be known.
European space officials have been celebrating the successful end of a 10-year, 6 billion kilometer chase. But they say now that the Rosetta probe has caught up with a comet, the first time that's ever happened, the hard work begins. It will spend the next few months studying the comet's surface, and if all goes well, in November, it will attempt to land on it. Robert Massey is from the UK's Royal Astronomical Society.
The appeal is that it's in the right place that the probe can get to it, and that crucially, not only will it go into orbit around it, which is a big deal in itself, but in November, it'll drop a lander on it, and there'll be this effort for the first time to have a probe stuck to the side of a comet.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We shall be back right after this.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And welcome to Midori House. It is 18:06 in London, 13:06 in New York City. And joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, and Daniela Peled, Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both. We shall start in Gaza, where a ceasefire is holding into a second day, allowing some of the 500,000 Palestinians displaced by the fighting to return to what remains of their neighbourhoods. Negotiations towards a lasting truce are continuing in Cairo. Israel want Hamas to disarm, which Hamas won't, and Hamas want Israel to lift the blockade of Gaza, which Israel won't, which, of course, were pretty much the positions 4 weeks and nearly 2,000 mostly Palestinian deaths ago. Daniela, first of all, both sides, as both sides generally do, are trying to claim this has been a victory of sorts. Are either of them right?
No, neither of them right. I mean, I don't see how this whole awful episode could be seen as in any sense of victory. As you said, we're back to where we started. And although the Israeli public has been overwhelmingly behind this operation, as ever, when active combat ends, comes a period of introspection and examination. And people are starting to ask, if it was about the so-called terror tunnels, not the tunnels which were built, you know, going into Gaza to bring in goods, but the tunnels which Hamas built under their border with the aim of attacking Israelis and kidnapping Israeli soldiers. If they'd been known about for years and years and years, why was something not done? I mean, Israel, from its point of view, has paid in a very high cost. The number of soldiers, more than 60 killed, is taken by the society where national service is compulsory. It's taken very, very seriously. So I think there's going to be some very, very strong questions asked of the military about its performance and of the political class as well.
Shashank, have either side accomplished anything at all here, really?
Do you know, we don't know yet. The peace talks in terms of for a lasting peace are ongoing still. And I think right now, Egypt, which of course despises Hamas under the present leadership, is resisting this Israeli push to say, you must terminate this by completely disarming Hamas. The Israelis are saying, what we want to see is not just a return to the status quo, but a demilitarization of Gaza. The Egyptians are saying, well, we can't quite deliver that. That's impossible. No one's crazy enough to go in and take Hamas's guns off them. But what we could do, for example, is put the authorities of the PA, the Palestinian Authority, on the border crossings with Egypt. So you can monitor what goes in and out. And thereby Hamas could say, we've eased the blockade. And the Israelis could say, we have contributed towards disarming Hamas. It's step one. So in other words, both sides could come away with this with something, something modest. But of course, that's the essence of any kind of deal. Anyway,
the question is, what will the Palestinian Authority get out of that deal?
Because well, what they will get is, of course, an opportunity to exert authority and control over Hamas, which makes smuggling revenue by taxing those goods, showing its authority in Gaza after 7 years in which it's been absent and confined to the West Bank. So I think it has something to show after a conflict, of course, in which Mahmoud Abbas, the PA president, has looked like an irrelevance.
I think it's a bit of a poison chalice. I think from what I understand, Gazans have been cursing Mahmoud Abbas in the same way they've been cursing al-Sisi over the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, where have they been? What have they done? And part of the quiet in the West Bank over the last 7 years has not been met with any kind of advance on peace talks or any kind of restrictions on settlements.
No.
So I think
quite the opposite.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think that Mahmoud Abbas will be very keen to take on Gaza. And I think the Israelis are very into that idea as well, mm-hmm. Without some incentive.
Shashank, you mentioned there the apparent unlikelihood of a serious operation to sort of disarm Gaza house by house. There has been a story floated in the Israeli press, including in Haaretz, suggesting that some senior Israeli officials were actually in favour of exactly that, of a complete reoccupation of Gaza, and that Benjamin Netanyahu decided against it. Daniela, I'll ask you first, does that sound likely, or is this spin trying to make Netanyahu look relatively reasonable?
Well, I have to say that Netanyahu has been relatively reasonable over this, including his...
The key word being relatively.
Well, relatively is very important because... And also his very hawkish defence minister as well, because Netanyahu, who I won't laud in any way as a kind of man of the left, has been cautious about committing troops on the ground. This wasn't something he wanted. I mean, the situation escalated, but I don't believe this was something that was planned from the beginning. There were other voices in the cabinet talking about occupying the whole of Gaza, something which I think the Israeli public would have thought was disastrous and something which is entirely impractical and a huge step backwards. They're fringe voices. But yes, I'm afraid I think that's true in this context. Netanyahu was a relative moderate, which doesn't really bode well for the future and for imminent political decisions.
And the biggest manifestation of this was not in Gaza, where actually he outmaneuvered his radical rivals quite easily, even sacked one of them, his deputy defence minister. But back in April, when it was his cabinet's opposition and Netanyahu's fear of his rivals that torpedoed peace deals, because he was not able to deliver the prisoner releases that were crucial to delivering on deals agreed with the Palestinian Authority. That's predominantly why peace talks collapsed back in the spring. He didn't think he could get those concessions passed. And so it's the old problem within Israel of domestic politics sabotaging potentially key foreign policy advances.
Daniela, you mentioned there the popularity of this offensive among the Israeli public. Is that mostly just driven by a kind of atavistic desire to hit back at people who are launching rockets at them? Because surely people can't think that there is the basis for a lasting peace in this. Surely at some level everybody must realise that 18 months, 2 years from now, they're going to go round again.
No one is thinking about a lasting peace, though. I mean, that's not on the table for any or all of the sides in this. And I think Israeli people, although the majority continue to support a two-state solution and would be willing to make all kinds of concessions for peace, they say that our children cannot live under threat of bombs and keep on running to bomb shelters. They say something must be done. How would you feel, they're saying? I mean, I think that this whole operation has been a disaster. But I think we should be careful about interpreting support for the operation as support for increasing pressure on Gaza or reoccupying Gaza or anything like that. The Israeli public wants something to be done. And I have to say, although I've got a very high opinion in general of Israeli journalism, the coverage of this war has been pretty appalling in some sections. I mean, the focus obviously is on a country's press is going to be on their country, their soldiers, their boys, their experience. But the Palestinian narrative has been largely absent from this, and there's been a very troubling lack of, you know, really looking at the human impact of this. I found that strange and upsetting.
Can I make one addition to that, which is simply that in today's Haaretz, the centre-left Israeli newspaper, Barak Ravid, the diplomatic correspondent, pointed out that, look, if this operation delivers a few years of success, it'll be considered, a few years of quiet, it'll be considered a success. And he pointed to Lebanon. He said the 2006 Second Lebanese War, which by most accounts was either a stalemate or a semi-victory for Hezbollah in staving off Israel, has bought peace since 2006. Now, many people would say, well, hang on, Hezbollah has looked inwards, consolidated, strengthened, acquired more and more support within Lebanon. Is that what you want with Hamas? But of course, the point is, as Daniela said, it's a short-term outlook. It's peace for now. Peace for a while, not peace forever.
Well, it's funny you should mention Lebanon, which is the next topic on our this evening's menu of utter potential and actual disaster. But Lebanon has been mopping up the most serious overspill yet from the civil war next door in Syria. 17 Lebanese soldiers have been killed, more than 30 reported missing, perhaps taken hostage in fighting in and around the town of Arsal near Lebanon's border with Syria. The town was seized by Sunni militants, apparently affiliated to the Nusra Front organisation and or for the Islamic State over the weekend. Shashank, I'll ask you first. There are reports, we should say, suggesting the militants have agreed to leave by tomorrow and give hostages back. What is in it for them? Is it possible to discern why they need to spread this into Lebanon from Syria?
Well, the fact is the Lebanese government over the past 6 years or so has become increasingly dominated by the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, a group that was formed by Iran in the 1980s, a Shia group now fighting on behalf of Syrian President Assad in next-door Syria. And so the Syrian rebels understandably think Hezbollah is responsible for their crushing defeats in Syria and wants to take the battle into Lebanon. That's why we've seen increasing bombings of Hezbollah strongholds inside Lebanon. And that's why we're now seeing attacks spread to other institutions of the Lebanese state, given that Hezbollah, although it doesn't formally control the government, does control many aspects of the Lebanese state, including intelligence and security agencies.
I think what's interesting as well is there have been offers from Saudi Arabia of significant aid.
$1 billion to the Lebanese military.
Well, that's British understatement. And of course, you know, if we're talking wars by proxy, Saudi Arabia, Iran, very, very much on opposite sides of this whole issue. Mm-hmm.
Is it surprising, Daniela, that the Syria, almost since fighting started in Syria, people have gloomily predicted that this would completely engulf Lebanon? It has not yet completely engulfed Lebanon. Is that surprising?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it was particularly hopeful, but I don't think anyone expected that the disaster to quite envelop Syria in the way that it did. People are right at the beginning, I remember, saying, oh, this bodes really badly for Lebanon, but the complete collapse of Syria was, you know, a step further in that kind of prediction.
But it's a bit like sitting in your living room while the sofa and TV and table are on fire and saying, sorry, everyone relax, it hasn't completely engulfed the house yet. Of course, you know, Lebanon's in a really perilous state. You're seeing in those border areas a really strong reaction in refugee camps against what they see as a vicious, sectarian, Iran-backed policy of pushing Hezbollah into their civil war in Syria. And Hezbollah is afraid as well. It knows it may be the strongest actor in Syria, but there is an independent army, which of course is why Sunni Saudi Arabia wants to use it to its own ends. There's still a weak, but you know, not non-existent Sunni opposition inside Syria as well. And I think Hezbollah realizes that it has stretched itself very thinly indeed, fighting not just in Syria, but also, by the way, in some small part in Iraq.
And also reported in the last few days, fighting their own war against Nusra and or the Islamic State in and around the Bekaa Valley. Would it be optimistic to suggest perhaps that this is going to end up uniting Lebanon's various disparate factions, if they've all discovered somebody, one faction they dislike more than each other? It's a thought.
No, yeah, if only that were the case. But, you know, this is a classic case of Saudi Arabia as well, looking to gain one over the Iranians and Hezbollah wherever they can, even if it comes at the expense of national stability, national unity or sectarian harmony.
Well, on that deeply happy note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller. Daniela Peled and Shashank Joshi will still be here when we return. Up next, Afghanistan.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Should cities ban the car? Can we make truly sustainable metropolises? What happens if neighbourhoods lose their corner shops? How do you put a stop to suburban decay? Do children belong in big bad capitals? Can Detroit be saved? Can Sydney become a cycle capital? Can we learn to love concrete? And are rich cities always boring? If you want the answers to the big questions facing our cities, you need to tune in to The Urbanist, Monocle 24 Radio's weekly show about the cities we live in. Expect global reports, great interviews, passionate debate, and some surprises too, because dragstar taxi drivers, love motel owners, and retail rebels also get their say. Presented by me, Andrew Tuck, The Urbanist premieres every Thursday at 1900 hours London time, and you can also download it from monocle.com or iTunes.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Daniela Pellid from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting and Shashank Joshi from RUSI. We shall turn now to Afghanistan, with America's military presence in the country theoretically in abeyance after 13 years. The US has suffered its highest ranking casualty. Major General Harold Green was killed yesterday by an Afghan soldier as he visited Camp Kaga near Kabul, the officer training school allegedly an Afghan equivalent to Sandhurst or West Point. At least 15 other soldiers of various nationalities were injured, including the camp's Afghan commander, General Ghulam Saki. Shashank, I'll ask you first. This phenomenon known as green on blues, i.e. the targeting of occupying troops by allegedly friendly local soldiers, became a bit of a thing a few years ago. There were 46 such incidents in 2012, which killed 60 people. Mm-hmm. Does the phenomenon, notwithstanding this event, seem to be dwindling, or are there just fewer Americans to shoot at?
That's exactly it. When I looked into this at the beginning of this year, or the end of last year, it occurred to me that about a fifth of all NATO casualties had occurred in such incidents, which is a shocking number to be killed by the people you're training. But what's happened is we're withdrawing increasingly into our bases. We're not going out on patrols like we used to. The Afghan National Security Forces, ANSF, are doing that by themselves. And increasingly, when I was in Afghanistan last year, you could see everywhere, there was a practice of guardian angels. Whenever there were allied personnel, ISAF personnel, there would always have to be someone whose role was not to participate in the activity, but to stand aside with assault weapons at the ready, essentially pointed at Afghans, the people who you were helping. And so all of that, I think, has served to mitigate this effect. But the biggest contributing factor, as you suggest, is simply shrinking, dwindling numbers. But I'll tell you, it's a sign of the times, of our complete uninterest in Afghanistan, that you have the most senior US casualty since Vietnam. A general is shot dead, and the newspapers don't care.
It is interesting in itself that it did barely rate any space at all. That's obviously against a backdrop of a fairly eventful foreign affairs news agenda at the moment. Daniela, it's now less than 2 years until the Afghan army is supposed to take charge. What if they're not ready?
Well, I mean, define readiness. I will inject a rare note of optimism into this. The Afghan army performed pretty well when it came to both rounds of the elections earlier this year. They were, relatively speaking, fewer incidents of violence, in both rounds. The issue is there going to be an American continued training presence? Now, both candidates for president have agreed that this is what's going to happen. Although they haven't agreed who's going to be president, that's another problem. I think it's impossible to tell. But if we look at what happened in Iraq, if there'd been an American presence, American military presence, continuing to sort of train and direct the army, would they have turned around and run away when ISIS turned up? I think this is an issue that's going to be considered. I mean, Afghanistan is no longer of great concern as a potential al-Qaeda training territory. There's plenty of places that can be exploited, and al-Qaeda is kind of yesterday's news as well. But I think the idea of a strategic American presence remaining in Afghanistan still remains quite important.
I think the issue isn't just the bilateral security agreement under which would permit the continuation of US forces. I think that's a foregone conclusion. Whoever wins, they're both for it, as you said.
Nobody wins? That's the concern.
I think we've just about averted that outcome, but that we did come close to it, of course. I think the bigger issue is cash. When the Soviets left Afghanistan, that's not what caused the collapse and the destruction of that Soviet-backed government, it was when the money ran out. And again, the US has said it'll fund Afghanistan until 2024. The ANSF will suck up $4 to $6 billion every year. The Afghan government does not have that much money, by the way. It's when Congress decides we've had enough of Afghans shooting our generals, and they say, sorry, we're not going to give you $4 billion a year. I can think of other places to use it. You know, Ukraine, anywhere else for that matter. That's when the Afghans are in trouble, because that's when the army dissolves from the top. And if there's no reconciliation with the insurgency by then, if there are no major reforms, no increase in revenue, or the Indians, Russians, Iranians haven't stepped in, that's the bigger problem for me looking ahead.
Okay, well, Shashank, you did mention Ukraine there, and you are making my job of stringing these together delightfully easy this evening. That's what we'll discuss finally tonight, and I think it's fair to say that though today's programme has thus far reinforced the truth that policymakers are not struggling for headaches at the moment, several fretful observers, including NATO and Poland, have suggested that Russia may be poised to invade Ukraine, at least to the extent that they haven't already. 20,000 troops have been moved up to the border, perhaps awaiting an invocation of a suitable pretext. But Shashank, I'll ask you first. We've been here before over the last few weeks. Vladimir Yes. Putin is getting a bit grand old Duke of York, isn't he? why does he keep moving his soldiers back and forth, and what does he hope to gain by doing it?
Well, it's brinksmanship, first of all. I think he's seen over the past month not only his own stupidity in assisting rebels cause a complete unified reaction from Europe turning against him, imposing sanctions, but more importantly, something we've missed, of course, amidst all of this European diplomacy in MH17, the Ukrainian government is winning. They're taking back these separatist cities. You know, Donetsk is encircled in many, effectively. The rebels are being squeezed out. I think he wants to engage in some kind of coercive diplomacy, as they call it, to try and essentially say, look, I don't want to invade. Everyone knows it's not the best Russian option. But if I'm under pressure, I'm given no other options, and you're not willing to negotiate a respectable way out for these rebels, I retain that option and I threaten it. And I wouldn't say it is beyond the realm of plausibility, given how much in a corner he now is.
See, I was naive enough to think 3 or so weeks ago, whenever it was that MH17 got shot down, that was the point at which the entire rebellion and Russia's association with it would just die of embarrassment. That is honestly what
you're applying logic there.
I am applying logic. Vladimir Putin has today applied a certain logic of his own by imposing retaliatory sanctions against the people who sanctioned him. Although, interestingly, while people try to punish Russia by banning exports, Russia's trying to punish everybody else, possibly themselves, who knows, by banning imports. This is mostly going to upset Russians, isn't it?
I mean, Russia has got form for this. You know, they banned imports of the rather excellent Georgian wine previously, claiming that there was sort of health and safety issues. I mean,
sure Russian wine is an excellent substitute.
It's really not.
This hurt both sides. But look, Vladimir Putin finds himself now in a position where he sold himself, the contractor he's sold to his people is, you know, give up your agency and your control over life, and I will look after you, and I'll provide stability, and including economic stability. Now he can't. Now if he retreats now, what is that going to show him as? You know, he's going to show him as a weak leader. And I'm not sure that I agree about that. The Ukrainian army is winning. I think perhaps that the Russians are thinking when it gets to the point of urban warfare, urban fighting, the Ukrainian army will then start losing. Because as we've seen in Gaza and many other places, once an army starts fighting in an urban zone, the casualties mount, things get worse. You know, I agree. I thought MH17 was going to be the turning point. It wasn't. And if that wasn't, then what will it take, really?
Well, my next question, at the risk of sounding like a hawkish headbanger, was, has it not been demonstrated to Putin over the last few months that basically he can do as he pleases? And might that, I'll put this to you first, Shashank, might that be tempting him if he's just thinking, I took back Crimea, no one really complained all that much. I fomented fairly openly a rebellion in eastern Ukraine, no one's all that bothered. You know, at one remove, I shot down a civilian airliner, and what have they done? You know, stopped buying my whatever it is we were selling them.
I think it's a little more than that. The reaction has been tepid and slow, but it has come. And the sanctions imposed by the US alone, before we even consider, I think, what were actually surprisingly serious sanctions by the EU just over a week ago, they will impose a substantial cost on a fragile and undiversified economy. In this week's interview with The Economist, Obama said, "Russians don't make anything." What a damning statement. And his point was, of course, that the sanctions will really bind for that reason. They can't just substitute this stuff from within. They can't produce good wine and they can't produce good machinery or goods. And that will hit them very hard. So the effect will not be seen immediately. But over time, I think you will see the Russian economy stagnate and Obama will bear that cost and will have to factor that in.
Daniela, what do you think? Will he march them back down again?
Oh, I was wanting to extend that analogy. I think that there's two things here. I mean, Putin is unlikely to change course unless there's his constituency. I mean, the very conservative constituency, the ordinary people, start to suffer and start to make trouble. But I also think what's dangerous really is that what does it do to embolden other actors on the international stage? I mean, it's very difficult. You can't go in straight away with hard hitting sanctions and take extreme action. But you're quite right. He has got away with it. He's got away with more and more and more and more. Shows no signs of stepping back. So who's next?
Well, as we've observed before in this space, crises in the Balkans in the summers of years ending in 14 very rarely come to anything. We will have to leave it there. Daniela Pellet and Shashank Joshi, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Monocle 24 です.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll head to Sao Paulo. We'll meet the author of Invisible, The Dangerous Allure of the Unseen. And we'll talk Australian television, you lucky people. But before we get started on all that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
NATO says a build-up of Russian troops on the border with Ukraine is a worrying sign that Russia may be preparing to launch a full-scale invasion. It says 20,000 combat-ready troops are now massed on the country's border. A ceasefire in Gaza has held for more than 36 hours now. Thousands of people who fled their homes during the conflict have started to return, and Israeli and Palestinian representatives have been holding separate talks in Egypt, trying to agree a longer-term deal. In Saudi Arabia, officials are investigating what may be the first Ebola death outside Africa in the current outbreak. A man was being treated in Jeddah. The World Health Organization is holding an emergency meeting discussing how to contain the outbreak, with new figures showing more than 900 lives have now been lost. And Iraqi officials say that as many as 60 suspected militants died in a drone strike in the rebel-held city of Mosul. It targeted a prison, which was being used as a base by ISIS fighters who'd gained control of the city 2 months ago. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul. Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. And today we are heading to Sao Paulo, where a bit earlier I caught up with Monocle contributor Claire Rigby.
There's been a record drought here, particularly in the state of Sao Paulo, but affecting other parts of South and Southeast Brazil. And I think that combined with some really serious problems of infrastructure and lack of investment are actually causing a record problem, and it's making people quite nervous here.
What kind of pronouncements have officials made on this? Are they talking about rationing or what would be called in Britain hosepipe bans or anything like that?
Yeah, they are. They're starting to talk about rationing. But, you know, in many ways it does feel a bit like too little too late. Having said that, I mean, you know, you don't see many advertisements for rationing, for one thing. But having said that as well, I think it's not even going to be the solution to the problem. I think it's quite a lot of the water that's used in Sao Paulo State goes to industry, which is you know, one of the motors of Brazilian industry here in Sao Paulo. And another major problem that's not really being addressed is the enormous amount of water that's just being wasted, that's leaking away from the water system.
Is there much anger about this from people in Sao Paulo towards the city authorities?
I think that there is a growing anger, actually, yes. Governor Alckmin, who's the governor of the state of Sao Paulo, standing for re-election again in October, is starting to come under fire from certain kind of quarters. But I think as well, to quite a large extent, there's quite a lot of people just putting their heads in the sand for now. People are a bit worried about it, but perhaps not really wanting to. I think with a lot of these ecological things as well, people don't always want to hear about them until they're really, you know, they're really serious. So, yeah, there's some criticism, but perhaps that's going to get worse as the crisis goes on.
Another story I know you wanted to talk about, this kind of a hangover from the World Cup, and for possibly understandable reasons, Brazilians are probably pretty keen to forget the World Cup ever happened, but might that be the reason why two protesters arrested during it are still in jail?
Yeah, I think this is kind of one of the major sort of unreported stories really from the World Cup. It was on the 23rd of June during a demonstration. I think the demonstration was actually against... it was actually for kind of price protection on public transport, but it kind of turned into a slightly anti-World Cup protest, and two protesters were arrested following the demonstration. They were accused of carrying explosives, and that was 43 days ago, and they're still in prison, they're on remand. And yesterday the results came back from the bomb squad, from the military police bomb squad, proving that none of the artefacts that had been on their persons or in their backpacks had any explosive or incendiary qualities, and yet they're still in prison. So it's another thing that I think there's a sort of slight, a very small but growing anger about that, and about the sort of brushing under the carpet of some of the problems that were happening around the World Cup that they didn't really want the world to see.
So what happens next with their case? Has anybody been clear on what their status is?
Their lawyers, of course, are pressing for their immediate release, but as far as of today, there hadn't been any news on that as to whether that would happen. In fact, I read a judgment that was made yesterday by a judge, a very strange pronouncement made by a judge calling them, he actually called them caviar protesters, I think, in a sort of loose translation, champagne socialists, and accused them of wearing Nike trainers and carrying mobile phones and wanting to sort of reap the fruits of capitalism while at the same time trying to bring it down. Quite a strange set of comments that the judge made. And yes, unfortunately, they haven't yet been released.
Finally, I wanted to move on to a new kind of nightlife phenomenon, I guess, in Sao Paulo and Brazil in general. This is the new thing that everybody is drinking. Introduce it, if you would.
It's catuaba. So, it's not really such a new thing as it's new to kind of certain parts of Sao Paulo. It's a really traditional, well, it's been going for about 20 years, I think. It's a traditional, very cheap alcoholic drink. It costs about 8 reais a bottle, which is about £2.50. It's called, the drink itself is catuaba. The very famous brand is called Selvagem, Savage, and it comes in a green plastic bottle that sort of looks a bit like a glass liqueur bottle, but is cheap plastic, with a sort of Stone Age hero on the front with a swooning woman in his arms. And it's growing in popularity here in Sao Paulo, which is really, really funny to see, because it's always been on sale for years and years in sort of dusty grocery stores. But it's kind of getting, I wouldn't go as far as to say trendy, but I think it's definitely getting in popularity, and apparently sold double last year what it had sold in the previous year.
How do people account for the upsurge in sales? Has there been a particularly clever new marketing campaign, or is it one of those things no one really understands?
I think it might be a little bit to do with a lot of festivals and events happening increasingly on the street in Sao Paulo. And so it's the kind of drink that you'll see people selling informally on street corners, perhaps down the Rua Augusta, which is one of the night sort of hotspots. I mentioned it last week. And I think people kind of have been reminded of it a little bit, perhaps. The other thing is that another drink has been made. I'm not sure if it's actually a formal drink, but there's another drink that's been mixing it with a sort of energy drink. Yeah, I think perhaps a couple of things coming together, just bringing it back into people's consciousness and reminding them that it's cheap, cheerful, and a fun drink.
What does it actually taste like?
It's not too bad, actually. It's like very weak wine, although it's actually about the same alcoholic. I think it's 16%. But it's a mixture of wine with some sort of apple juice, and supposedly the main ingredient, which it does have some in it, is catuaba, which is a herbal, and there's guarana in there as well, some Brazilian plant extracts, which are supposed to be aphrodisiac. So hence the label with the swooning woman on the label.
Claire, on that potential poster slogan for them, Catawba, but not too bad, actually, we will leave it. Thank you very much, Claire Rigby in Sao Paulo.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take five times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. It's just gone 18:40 in London. Now, invisibility is a common fantasy and a common terror. It's something we may wish we were when our workplace is being solicited for volunteers to come in on Saturday, and something we wish we weren't when trying to get served later that evening. It is understandable that the idea of invisibility has fascinated people for as long as our brains have been sufficiently advanced to articulate the concept, and that it has interested the science writer Philip Ball enough to write a book about it. Invisible, the dangerous allure of the unseen. Philip joins me now, although obviously as we're on the radio, you will just have to take my word for it. You sort of looked at invisibility, or the idea of invisibility, over the ages since we first thought of it. Is it more desired or more feared, or is it about even?
Well, it's something that people have desired for a long time, but I think one of the morals that you get from looking back at the sort of cultural history of invisibility is that it's often as much a curse as it is a promise or an advantage. And this is something that H.G. Wells' character found in The Invisible Man, that he dreams of world domination. And once he's invisible, he finds everyone bumps into him. He can barely walk because he can't see his feet. So, you know, it has its drawbacks.
And it is obviously a vast and appropriately ineffable subject. How do you go about structuring a book about it?
It, like many things, it starts with Plato. And in fact, Plato provides the context for the whole theme that I wanted to explore, because my thesis is that invisibility isn't something that we should try to engineer. It's not a technological challenge. It's a moral challenge. And this is what Plato said in the story that he told in The Republic of a shepherd who found a ring of invisibility. The shepherd's name was Gyges. And he found this ring and straight away went to the court of the king, seduced the queen, killed the king, and became the ruler of Lydia, the land he was in. And Plato's point was, if any of us can escape responsibility for our actions, if we can essentially hide what we do, how can we ever resist these temptations? How can we be trusted to be just? And so he sort of sets this up as the whole question of how to create a just state if the rulers can kind of do what they like with impunity because they can hide it, which clearly is, you know, an issue that we're thinking about today.
This is not something we've kind of conquered yet. No, and I suppose what that plays into, it's the way people in crowds behave vastly differently to the way they would when they were out and about, because they are shielded by the crowd.
Well, I think we see that even more with the phenomenon on the internet, of internet trolling, that, you know, once we're faceless, once we're unseen and anonymous, or think we are, then it does seem that, at least for some people, their sense of moral responsibility erodes, and they start behaving in ways that they wouldn't do if they were on public display, if they were seen, if they knew the people knew who they were.
Because you talk about invisibility not just as, you know, the idea of a single person suddenly becoming unsightable. There's an idea, and again, it's one that I think has been very much fueled by social media discussion, of invisibility of entire groups of people or subsets of people, certain people who feel like they're not heard from enough, or that others are heard from too much.
Yeah, well, this is the metaphor that we often have for speaking about disadvantaged groups in society, or marginalised groups, that they have become invisible. And that idea was very much explored in the book called Invisible Man by the black American writer Ralph Ellison in the 1940s. He wrote about the alienation of a lot of black Americans, and in particular of someone like him who was an intellectual, a black intellectual, who didn't really conform to the expectations either of the white majority or of what you might call conventional African-American society. And so he feared that in that sort of situation, you do become invisible. And Ellison's book is really, I think, the sort of cornerstone of all these discussions about how groups can be marginalized and can vanish from society.
I did want to ask, though, about the invisibility in its science fiction form, as in, you know, of that person or that vehicle that can render themselves unsightable by anybody else. And this is an idea that obviously fascinates militaries for very, very obvious reasons. It's where we get camouflage from. But how much research has there been done into the idea of actually making people or vehicles actually invisible?
Well, you're right that, you know, initially, and going back, in fact, even to Roman times, there's this idea of camouflaging armies to allow them to sort of sneak up on the enemy. But you could say that's a kind of invisibility, but it's not, you know, literally making something transparent or see-through or that you can't see it's there. That idea is now starting to sort of come around. It's certainly been around for some time with stealth technology, where you want to make something invisible from radar.
Yeah.
And the way to do that is to reduce the reflections from radar. And essentially, you sort of shrink the effective size of the object until it becomes, you know, as big as a fly or something. But today we have the emergence of a possibility of kind of doing this for real, of bending light so that it travels around an object and comes back together again on the far side, like water flowing around a boulder in a stream, so that it looks to the observer on the other side as though the light has just sort of come straight from the source without anything in the way. And people have found ways of making structures, essentially sort of electronic structures, that will have this effect on light, or at least so far on microwaves, so that it can, the hope is that it can render effectively invisible something that's inside this shield that bends the light around it.
There's a lot of consideration in the book of fictional depictions or mythological depictions of invisibility over the years. How have they evolved?
Well, what I really wanted to do in the book was to ask what those were about. And that, I hope, would provide some context for this latest work that's being done on these invisibility shields. And in general, when we tell these stories about invisibility, they're like all myths and legends and fairy tales. They're really about us. They're about our desires and our hopes and dreams and fears. And so in general, when someone becomes invisible in these old tales, it's in order to do something. And very often, in fairy tales at least, they're not concerned about the how. It's a ring or a talisman or something. It's what they do with it. And in general, they tend to travel between worlds, between a fairy world and this world, or they use it for purposes of seduction or power. So it's about really our own dreams and fantasies.
Well, I won't ask you what you would do yourself if endowed with invisibility, because I know that, like all authors, you just go into bookstores and put all your books at the front of the shelves. Philip Ball, thank you very much. Philip's book, Invisible, The Dangerous Allure of the Unseen, is out now or now aboutsish. It's time now for a bit of music. We will shortly be reviewing the latest in Australian television. To take us there, the soundtrack from a great, nay, landmark Australian television moment, the 1988 Neighbours wedding of Harold and Madge Ramsay. This is The Triffids. God, they were good. That was The Triffids with Bury Me Deep in Love from their 1987 album Calenture, though if you are unfamiliar with their work, you should start with the one before that, Born Sandy Devotional. It's time now, anyway, to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the worlds of cinema, theatre, books, etc. Today, as threatened previously, we're talking television and we're heading to Australia. A bit earlier, we caught up with Monocle's Melbourne correspondent Adrian Craddock, who's been watching Australian television, so you didn't have to. Here's Adrian.
For the first time, Neighbours has actually hired its first Indigenous actor. And of course, Neighbours, for your listeners who don't know, is a very, very famous Australian TV soap opera that is syndicated around the world. It's very popular in England, actually. But just very recently, they've hired their first Indigenous actor. He's a guy from Kalgoorlie in my home state, and he plays kind of a friend of one of the main characters. I haven't actually seen him in action yet, but I hear he's very good.
Fantastic. I mean, not trying to compare, but, you know, we're going to talk about Indigenous issues as well. There's a political program in Australia called Q&A. Can you tell us a bit more?
Yeah, exactly. So Q&A is a very popular program in Australia. It's on the ABC, which is our national broadcaster. And it's a format which follows closely Question Time, which I believe you have in the UK, which is basically where a panel of experts or politicians all kind of sit down in a studio and a live audience asks them questions. This Q&A that aired recently on Australian TV was quite different, actually, because the latest episode broadcasted from Arnhem Land, which is an area in the north of Australia, which is it's very significant for Indigenous Australians. And this edition of Q&A, it was a real event, actually. It's the most expensive episode they've ever done. And it basically it explored a lot of issues that are relevant to Indigenous Australians. And it was actually really fascinating. It was a real kind of event for the ABC.
How can we change the mindsets of these racist thinkers?
Racism hurts. The comments that people make about you and your Aboriginality leaves a mark. But racism doesn't go away, because even in my current role, I still get barbs from people. I get the trolls on social media. I ignore them because I feel sorry for them, because I see myself no different to any other person.
It was really interesting. The one thing I would say is that it was a little bit disconcerting that the entire panel was Indigenous, more or less. I mean, apart from Tony Jones, the host, it was a predominantly Indigenous panel. And I think it would have been really interesting to have someone, especially someone senior within the government. I mean, both major Australian parties were represented, both Labor and Liberal politicians were on the panel. But it would have been really interesting to get a white Australian view on the issue as well, because, you know, it is all about drawing bridges between the two cultures. And I think in some ways, even though it was fascinating to hear a really in-depth discussion of some of these important issues from the Indigenous world, I think it would have been also beneficial to have a bit of diversity on the panel as well. But it definitely was a fascinating discussion, and there have already been talks about making it possibly an annual part of the ABC's broadcasting, so it might happen every year.
Well, that sounds very interesting. But Adrian, moving on to your next show, actually, which is something a little bit funnier. I'm very curious to see that, actually. Hamish and Andy's gap year in South America. Did they go to Brazil?
They go to your homeland, Faye. So Hamish and Andy is like, they're the most famous Australian comedy double act. I find them really funny, to be honest. They're not particularly highbrow, or, I mean, really even particularly, you know, it's not particularly smart humour, but they really tap into a very Australian type of humour. It's all about mateship, really. It's all about they have this incredible friendship, and it's all about their travels around the world. It mainly centres around the two guys, Hamish and Andy, and they travel to different parts of the world, and they kind of play pranks on each other. They kind of discover, you know, different interesting things about different continents, and sometimes it can actually go wrong. I mean, one episode that was broadcast last night, it was actually quite hard to watch. Hamish, who, you know, Andy is more of the straight guy. Hamish is the kind of bubbly, kind of funny one. Hamish went to a small village off the Amazon, and he engaged in this kind of initiation ceremony that a lot of tribes do in that part of the world. And basically what it was is it was a pain ceremony. It was this village, they have this ceremony where they put ants, they're called bullet ants, which apparently they have the worst sting in the entire world, and they put a lot of them into these gloves. And basically Hamish, to do this ceremony, he had to put his hand into these gloves and get stung by these ants kind of hundreds of times. Yeah, it was supposed to be quite a funny kind of thing where it's like, oh my God, you know, how can he do this? But he actually ended up in hospital. It was so excruciatingly painful. So it was actually quite hard to watch. But usually, I mean, it's a lot more lighthearted than that.
I leant forward and presented my hands.
Oh, God.
Could I put these gloves on and keep my cool in front of the tribe?
Have mercy.
Obviously not. Jeez, with a couple of deep breaths, though, I felt like I'd be back to normal in no time.
Can I get you a Panadol? A Nurofen Plus?
And Adrian, just moving on for your last show as well, let's talk about ABC's first digital-only show.
The ABC at the moment have this really interesting initiative called Fresh Blood. And basically what it is they have given a lot of up-and-coming filmmakers, mainly comedy filmmakers, $10,000 each. And they're commissioned to do a series, like a mini-series of about three programs each. And I think about 20 different filmmakers got this grant. And the films that they made are put on the Australian version of iPlayer, like BBC's iPlayer. It's an online platform. It's really fascinating, actually. The stuff that they've put together has been really of a very high quality. I mean, some of it is kind of downright silly. There's a show called The Bogan Spy Agency, and Bogan is like an Australian word for redneck. Like it's about these spies who are all kind of, they've all got mullet haircuts and wear kind of flannelette shirts, and I don't know, it's okay, but it's not particularly great. But some of the other ones are really of a very high standard. There's one called Australia Think Tank.
Is that your favorite?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And it's all about a very serious think tank in Canberra. They're all idiots, basically. There's a group of about four of them sitting in this small kind of bureaucratic room in Canberra, and they have to come up with different things that will benefit the nation. For example, like a new Australian anthem, or, you know, a new national frog is one of their tasks. So I think we also have a clip of this one as well.
Argentina's already taken the magnificent tree frog.
How can you compete with that?
No, we don't want to be like the Argentinians. A frog that beautiful makes you look insecure.
Also, we don't want to look like a country that objectifies frogs.
Yeah, Australia already has a pretty big inferiority complex.
The biggest inferiority complex in the Southern Hemisphere.
That sounds very interesting, Adrian. Thank you so much for the review of the Australian TV. Thank you so much.
Adrian Craddock telling Fernando Augusto Pacheco what he could be watching if he was in Australia. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to our special guests Shashank Joshi and Daniela Peled at the top of the program. The show was produced by Daniela Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chiara Ramella. Our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines is The Entrepreneurs, so do stick around for that, and stick around also for The Monocle Daily with me and Chloe Potter at 2200 hours. Midori House returns at 18:00 tomorrow London time, but for this edition it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
From London, Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.